My daughter recently was told that she was selected to join the National Honor Society. And while I did not tell her this, my first thought was, I wonder how much that costs. So I recently had a phone conversation with my father, and I said, hey, Dad, good news. Your granddaughter was selected to join the National Honor Society. To which he said, National Honor Society, huh? How much does that cost? Mac Engel, Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Engel podcast here in the Sunset Lounge. Guest for this episode is award-winning sports columnist and published author, Mr. Mike Vaccaro of the New York Post. Mike has been in the thick of it in the New York sports scene for more than 20 years, and he recently has a new book out detailing a man who was Jerry Jones before Jerry Jones, a man whose personality and influence was so big that you can see his fingerprints all over a certain president who goes by the name of Trump, George Steinbrenner. Now, George Steinbrenner died several years ago, but when George Steinbrenner owned the New York Yankees, he was by far and away the most influential, visible, and controversial owner in all of sports. And so much of what you see now with the Dallas Cowboys and Jerry Jones, and to a lesser extent, but still an extent, with Donald Trump, George Steinbrenner started back when he bought the New York Yankees in the 70s and really in his heyday in the 80s and certainly in the 90s. One detail about George Steinbrenner that people forget is that he was suspended for life by Major League Baseball. And it was a detail that was covered in this book that I had completely forgotten about. And I certainly remember George Steinbrenner's controversial and very colorful owner's tenure as the owner of the New York Yankees. But there were other parts, including this one, that I had forgotten. Well, Mike, in his new book, The Bosses of the Bronx, covers all of these details, as well as certainly the transition of ownership of the Yankees from George Steinbrenner to his two sons, Hal and Hank, that have pursued it, that have been much, much quieter than George Steinbrenner's tenure as owner of the Yankees. It's a fascinating book, and really the part that interested me so much was the influence that George had on the current owner of the Dallas Cowboys, and certainly the President of the United States, because George knew Donald Trump when Donald Trump was a real estate guy who aspired to own professional sports franchises, specifically in the NFL or potentially even Major League Baseball, back in the 80s. So without any further ado, please welcome Mike Vaccaro. So, Mike, when I wrote down all this, so I've got a list of questions for you. Anytime I do this, sure. I try to, and I've got your book. By the way, this was really good. I have not finished it. I have not finished it yet, but I want to thank you for sending it to me. This was really good, and I learned a lot of things about George and certainly Hank that I had no clue about. But having gone through the excruciating process of writing a book myself, one question I always ask authors when the book is done is, do you like it? Do you like it?
You know, Mac, I do. It's my fourth book. I haven't written one in a number of years. I was fortunate enough to be able to write three in a 5-year splurge about 15 years ago, which is, I wouldn't recommend that pace to anybody. I like those books a lot. I think by the end, I needed a break and a breather. And I think that allowed me to appreciate not just the opportunity to write this book, but the process of doing it too. I mean, I just really thoroughly enjoyed the research, the reporting. The writing was really fun. But I wanted to write, what ultimately became the idea was Steinbrenner from literally the moment that he bought the team and then on toward, you know, Hank for a little bit, and now Hal owning the team. And that really appealed to me because just in a lot of ways, just the difference between the Yankees I cover now and the Yankees I covered when I first came to town, when George was still pretty active, and the Yankees that I grew up with, not necessarily rooting for, but following, because it was, you know, impossible not to follow the Yankees if you're reading the Post and the Daily News and Newsday and the Times every day, as you could when I grew up. And you know, just the magnificent chaos that reigned for years, for decades. And it wasn't all George doing the chaos, but he always orchestrated it. There was a really famous picture of him in a photo illustration of him in New York Magazine years ago, where he's got like, he's like a marionette with like the strings above Yankee Stadium, which is really what he was. And so all the craziness that followed at least was partially on his watch. And so being able to record all of that, go back and revisit it, kind of like, you know, introduce fresh generations to people who only knew George Steinbrenner as this kindly old man, you know, toward the end.
Yep.
That was all fun. And so as a result, you know, and it's interesting, Mac, because I know you go through this harrowing process when all of a sudden the box arrives and there's your supply of books. Now you can actually read what the rest of the world is going to read. You know, until that moment, the only people who have read this are you. Maybe maybe a family member, your wife or a friend or whoever, maybe your editor, well, definitely your editor, hopefully. and then of course the select group of people that are going to blurb the book. And you know, it's interesting, we still haven't found a book where the blurb goes, "This book sucks." You know, they're always safely ensconced in the hands of people that you know are going to be nice to you, right? So
yes.
So this is the first time that you have this book that other people with critical eyes are going to read. And I guess, I would not be telling the truth if I didn't say when I read it again, and I did read it again cover to cover when it arrived, it wasn't just a cool thing, because it's always a cool thing to crack open the spine of your new book.
Yeah.
But I really did like it. I'm not going to say it's better or worse than any of the other things I've done. I do think it's better, though.
So as you can imagine, where I live, we are heavily influenced by similar character, almost caricature, in Jerry Jones. And as I sat here reading this and contemplating what to ask you, I thought, are the New York Yankees the Dallas Cowboys? Are the Yankees the Cowboys?
I think it's interchangeable. You know, it's interesting that they're sort of business partners, the Legends Corporation, that they co-own. I mean, it means our press room food's better than most places.
Amen.
So it costs more, but it tastes good. It's worth it. But yeah, there are a lot of similarities. And yeah, I think you got to start with the fact that you have a dominant figure at the center of it. You know, certainly if we're talking about the Steinbrenners of George's time, Hal is still a dominant voice. He just doesn't speak as much as his father did. But look, and I've been around Jerry Jones enough of those crazy post-game impromptu press conferences to know that if you want a pretty good column, and especially if you're coming from out of town and you're not used to it, you know where to find them. You know where to find it. It's usually with him. Same thing, you know, if you ever get to do a trip for a Knicks game to Dallas, and you know, Mark Cuban was on his exercise bike and wanted the whole court, you're probably going to get a column out of that too, right? I will say that I think George was probably a little crazier in that, even when he was like in his prime, I mean, he would just say and do the just off the wall things that some of them I think were designed to get a message to somebody. Some of them were because he was as much of a lunatic fan as any of the callers to sports radio. And part of it is just what his personality was. He was a larger than life guy who was his whole life wanted to be the big guy in the big town and wanted to get the good table at the 21 Club, and ultimately did all of that. And I think I'm sure probably locally Jerry's probably looked at the same way, you know, and I know that, you know, he's still going strong in terms of, you know, shaking things up, you know. But you know, I think the thing that I took away from that documentary from last summer was that you forget, and it's the same thing with George too, I think, to a degree, you forget that, look, I mean, they didn't just show up and win these teams in a blind lottery. I mean, they had done well previously enough in their lives and other businesses to be able to own the Yankees, own the Cowboys. And look, I mean, Jerry's investment in the Cowboys was a lot steeper than the $168,000 that George's initial investment was with the Yankees. But you know, these are smart guys who sometimes their mouth gets in the way. I get it, but you know what? I mean, I know for the Yankees there was always a genuine love-hate relationship that extended to both ends of the extreme. And at least from a distance, it seems like that's certainly the case with Jerry Jones.
So in keeping along the lines of the Cowboys and the Yankees being interchangeable, George Steinbrenner, whom you knew, was a larger-than-life personality. And to me, I see a lot of similarities to Jerry Jones, a lot. Are they the same guy?
In a lot of ways, I think they're very similar, Mac. I do. And look, I mean, you know, I think now I don't think I'm speaking out of school, even though I don't cover the Cowboys. It seems like a lot of the Cowboys' problems, at least directly or indirectly, can be tied to the fact that he's very involved still, right? I mean, his opinions in the franchise still matter, sometimes, often, not always for the good, right? Mm-hmm. And there were long stretches of time for this. When George was going through the phase when he was most closely resembles what I see from afar with Jerry Jones, was in the 80s. And look, the Yankees won more games than anybody in the 80s and didn't come close to winning a championship. That probably sounds very familiar, right?
Is that right?
Yeah, they won more games than any baseball team in the 80s. And they you know, because their last championship was 78. They had really good teams in the early part of the 80s before it fell out. But, you know, in those years, it was just, you know, you won the division or you didn't, or you went home and they finished second a lot. And, you know, they just never could get back because, you know, Georgia do crazy things like walk into Lou Piniella's office one day and say, hey, I just won you the pennant. I got you Steve Trout. And same with a straight face. And, you know, what's Piniella going to do? Piniella wanted to take a baseball bat to his own skull to take himself out of his misery. And, you know, you could see, right? I mean, if I told you that that Jerry Jones had a similar conversation last week with Brian Schottenheimer, that would surprise you, wouldn't it?
No, he's done it.
Maybe not Steve Trout, but maybe Steve Trout.
You know, well, the one thing, I don't know if George did this to Stump Merrill, Billy Martin. What Jerry will do is every now and then, one of the big misnomers about the head coach of the Cowboys, they have way more influence than people think, way more influence. But every now and then, Jerry will do something to whomever, specifically the coach, and remind you, I'm running the team. And if I want Greg Hardy on this team, he's on the team. If I want to do this draft pick, that's what we're doing. Did George do that to GMs or managers?
Well, he did it. He did it a lot more bluntly. He would just fire them, and that would be the message. You know, look. I mean, again, you know, people just think of George, you know, the avuncular, you know, older man who let Joe Torre stay on the job for 12 years and Brian Cashman stay on the job for even longer. But that wasn't him. You know, when he was at the peak of his powers, you know, he hired and fired Billy Martin 5 times. And he would have hired him the 6th, except Billy inconveniently died before he could. He was going to be hired that season at some point. There was no question in anybody's mind that that's what would have happened, and it would have kept happening. He went through, you know, different iterations of Lou Piniella 3 times. I mean, you know, Stick Michael is credited with saving the Yankees when George was suspended the 2nd time, but that was his 2nd time as a GM. He'd been the manager 2x. I mean, that's what George did. I think that's probably where the fundamental difference is, because if I'm not mistaken, the one thing that Jerry is almost to a fault is he maybe keeps a coach around a year too long, as opposed to, you know, getting rid of him that way. But yes, in addition to the firing, there would also be the torture that would come before, you know, and like he would say that his biggest regret as the owner was to fire Dick Houser when he did, which is after 1 year, and all Houser did was win 103 games, a manager of the year, and none of those other teams in the great 70s teams won nearly as many as 103. That team did. He got fired after getting swept out of the playoffs by the Royals. And the precursor to that was they were scuffling in August, and they lost a big lead to the Orioles before they rebounded. And George was on Houser every day about how he wasn't Earl Weaver. He just wasn't Earl Weaver. You know, Baltimore's got this veteran guy. He's clever. He's smart. And we got a rookie manager. And, you know, later on, I think George reluctantly offered up that he realized he was probably in the wrong about Houser, because one day he was in Seattle and they were playing the Mariners and they were managed by Maury Wills. And he told the writer, he said, you know, I think I got a good shot this weekend. It's me against another rookie manager. I think that's more my speed. You know, and obviously he had the ultimate revenge on George by going to Kansas City and winning a championship with them during the 80s, which was a time which was a vast dry spell for the Steinbrenners. So, you know, that was the games he would play with Billy Martin were, you know, sometimes you look back on it and you think it's almost sadistic, you know. Because he knew that Billy loved that job so much that no matter how he treated him, no matter how many times he fired him, he was going to be able to bring him back. And then make a few dollars by doing a Miller Lite commercial or by doing some vaudeville acts at the press conference. I mean, do yourself a favor and go to YouTube and type Steinbrenner Martin Miller Lite, and you'll find the greatest 30-second commercial that's ever been done. especially if you remember that this was like 2 days after after one had been fired by the other and then rehired by him. So it's just, it's great. So, I mean, when you get to the level of mania, I don't think that Jerry Jones actually kind of comes close to him in that, but that's just the silliness. That's the, you know, I say it's silliness, but to me, it's the fun part of the book is going through all this manner of silliness that really did kind of go along with all the other stuff with the Yankees, which includes a lot of winning through the years, let's be honest, but also a lot of nuttiness.
So having grown up and lived in New York City for as long as you did, the greater New York area, and now Covered it for as long as you have, you've seen these giant, larger-than-life personalities because of the amount of attention, amount of coverage they get. They just sort of kind of grow organically. And one of them that somebody mentioned to me, and I didn't even think about it, how long this particular figure has been in the public spotlight long before he got the job he's in now, and that's Donald Trump. Now, I do not want to, at the behest of the people who run this these podcasts, this is not a political platform.
Sure. No, I understand.
Donald's personality, whatever you want to say about him, he was a prominent figure even back in the 80s, and people in sports were introduced to him because of his famous handling of his USFL franchise, the New York, New Jersey Generals, whatever you want to call him. And as I sat there and I read about George and his personality and his love of the spotlight, were they the same guy?
Oh, you got that so right. It's amazing. It's funny. George got a call sometime in the early 80s. Somebody wanted to see if he was willing to sell the Yankees for about $150 million. And he said, nope, not interested. And so Donald Trump hung up the phone, and then he bought the Generals and the USFL instead. Trump, I think, always fancied himself at one day maybe being able to own the Yankees if he didn't pursue other interests, which he wound up doing. But if you read the book, I mean, and this kept coming back to me time after time after time. And look, they were close friends. We've seen recently a letter that surfaced of Steinbrenner telling Trump that he hopes someday he runs for president. But Trump was always in Steinbrenner's owner's box. I mean, his owner's box for big games were these bold-faced of all the who's who of New York.
Yeah, I remember that.
And, of course, there was never a who in New York than Donald Trump in the 80s. And, you know, when you go through the book, and especially the quotes from, like, the 80s and the 90s that have been out there for a while, you realize that Donald wasn't just influenced by him. I think he studied him. I do. Because a lot of, if you close your eyes, when after you've read a couple of these Steinbrenner quotes from 1978 or 1981, it sounds like they came from Trump a lot of ways. Talking about the Yankees as opposed to other things. But just enough bluster to have that front, but also enough confidence and enough, look, I mean, you know, George could be funny. He wasn't going to, you know, that's not the reason he showed up on Seinfeld or Saturday Night Live. He didn't get those gigs because he was funny, but he appreciated humor, I guess is the best way to put it. And so, you know, all of these things made those quotes, you know, hold up 20 and 30 and 50 years later. And I think I think Trump paid attention to that. I do. I think that there are a lot of times now, subsequent to writing the book, that I'll hear something that the president says, and I'll laugh because I can hear it in George's voice. Or maybe it's the Larry David interpretation of of George's voice, but it's in one of the voices. And I think I definitely think there was a clear connection in terms of Donald studying George's every move, and to the point where I think he actually adopted some of his mannerisms also.
So when you know a subject as well as you did before you took this book on, that leads itself to a lot of advantages. Obviously, you have an innate familiarity with the topic that you're going into.
Sure.
But you're going to ultimately stumble across an anecdote, something or that you just missed. Maybe you even forgot, but likely you just didn't know. What's the one or two, Mike, that you came across that just absolutely made you stop and said, I'll be damned, I had no idea that happened?
Well, I'll ask that question two ways. One is one that really blew me away, just because, you know, see why in a second. And the other one is one that I actually was in the middle of, and I had just forgotten the details until I went back and I studied it, and kind of, you know, sometimes you spark your own memory. And the first one is you know, George's renown in the 80s was to, he did this all the time. He got rid of a boatload of all future all-stars. I mean, he just unloaded Willie McGee and Fred McGriff and Doug Drabeck and a bunch of others, you know, Jay Buhner.
Yeah.
And, you know, and invariably, you know, you'll be hard pressed to think of who the player was in return because they were immediately forgettable. A lot of them didn't ever play again.
Love Ken Phelps's bat.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, Frank Costanza was not pleased with that trade, as we both know. And so there was this random story I just saw in an old New York Post from like 1982. I want to say Maury Allen or somebody wrote it. And they were quoting this player for the Nashville Sounds who just went off. And he said, you know the problem with this organization? He said, if you're too good, they're going to trade you. And if you're not as good as they are, they're going to bring somebody else to block you. And that was a first baseman named Buck Showalter, who later on, of course, went on to manage the Yankees. And it's funny, when I uncovered that, I was like, I've never seen this before. And I actually called Buck. I said, did you really say this? And he's like, yes, and it was true. I'm like, that's great, thank you. And so that's in the book, and I'm pretty proud of that one. But the other one, and Mac, this was maybe the most the proudest day in the history of American sports writing, I would think, because it was the last day of spring training in 1999, and Hideki Arabu, who is like a ballyhooed import from Japan.
I covered him with the Rangers.
Oh, sure. So, yeah. You know, he would have these games where he really did look like Nolan Ryan, but most of the time he looked like, you know, David Clyde. And I love David Clyde. Always love that story from when I was a kid with the baseball cards. But he was always overweight. And George, of course, was always a banana about the players and being weight. He was a football coach at heart.
And he smoked. So one day, and I remember he smoked.
Yeah, he smoked. Yeah, which is hilarious, right?
Right.
And probably, and sadly, probably explains why he's no longer with us. Yeah. One of the reasons. But, you know, so this day he had a terrible day fielding, doing pitcher fundamentals and it was during a game, and it just, you know, after the game, we got Steinbrenner and had been thinking of Arabu, and he called him, and I can say this, he called him a fat pussy toad. And of course, now when you say it, you know exactly what you mean, right? You mean like the green ooze that comes from an infection, right? And I mean, how great is Steinbrenner to have, you know, to be able to actually get? But the problem is, we all go back to the press box and we're like, oh, wait a second. This looks like another word that I don't think we can use. And so for the next couple of hours, at every newspaper covering the Yankees, the writers were having the same discussions with their editors. And so, like, I think it was the Daily News went with ellipses. So it was fat ellipsis toad, right? I think the Newsday did too. Jack Curry at the Times insisted that they go P-U-S hyphen S-Y. So pussy looks that way.
They won't know.
Right. They won't know. The Post, I wasn't at the Post then, but the Post decided to go with pussy and in parentheses rhymes with fussy. I was the Star Ledger then, and this is why this is such a great memory to stroll back on. I was working with the great Tim Brown, who was one of my favorite colleagues ever, and he's got a great book on Nolan Ryan coming out, as you probably know, coming soon. Yeah. And we were having this discussion among ourselves. What do? We call the office. And so you have to understand, this is 1999. The Star Ledger had just recently begun what became a pretty close partnership with the producers of The Sopranos, because the Star Ledger was the paper that Tony got at the end of his driveway every day. And so because of that, we kind of knocked down one wall of decorum, I guess you would say, because we actually referred to Vincent Pompitiero by his nickname, which was Big, the other pronunciation of what that word looks like. And so they said, so we had no problem writing the word. They just said, spell it differently. And so that's how we came up with P-U-S-S-I-E, because that was a different spelling than the character's name. And that ended one of the great days in American journalism. And I remembered that, but like going back and reading like the stuff we wrote, and all of a sudden, and then talking to Brownie and talking to a few other guys that day, they were all having the same conversations. And, you know, I get it. This isn't a book about sports writers. There's some passages in there about Steinbrenner's relationship with the press and what the press meant to the building of the Steinbrenner brand and mythology, because there has to be. But that's a story that I think even an accountant or a teacher or a painter could probably appreciate, because it's just insane. And it's kind of like the copyrighted insanity that was part of every day when you were covering George Steinbrenner in his prime.
Hello, it's Mike Reiner of Your Dark Companion here. Let me ask you, are you looking for something to fill the long dead air hours of your day? Well, join the Sunset Lounge DFW and your dark companion on Patreon.com, YouTube, and wherever you get your podcasts. Replace those sad, slow hours with sports, pop culture, music woven into interesting conversations. So step inside the green door, have a seat at the bar, and get in the groove with those shows and so very much more.
So when you look back on this, and I've had this discussion with a lot of people about Jerry Jones, and I have my own thoughts and feelings about Jerry's influence and impact, not just on the Cowboys or the NFL, but the American sports scene in general. Right. And what I saw when I was reading this was I forgot just how much people hated George Steinbrenner.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about it. But at the same time, I thought as I was reading it, much in the same way that I think Jerry has been very good for the NFL, I thought ultimately George was really good for Major League Baseball, was he?
Oh, there's no question. No, I agree with you on that one, Mac. Look, and this comes up every couple of years when people talk about the Hall of Fame, you know, and his son says, you can't write the history of football, or the history of baseball, excuse me, without including a couple of chapters about George Steinbrenner. And to me, if he could do that, then he probably belongs in the Hall of Fame for whatever else he did during his time. And I would tend to agree with that. But I said earlier about one of the really nice things about this book is I do think it's introducing the vintage George to people who just weren't born then or just weren't old enough to appreciate it then, or frankly, to people who definitely went through it and have recency bias and just amnesia about the way it was. I had a really interesting talk one time years ago with Jim Dolan, who owns the Rangers and the Knicks.
You got to talk to Jimmy Dolan?
Yeah, I know. It's actually one of the bold-faced items in my resume because he only talks about once every 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
I was never necessarily one of his favorite. You know what they got it? He saw me in a Rangers game one time, and he loved the fact that I covered the Rangers, so he just called me and said, hey, want to talk? And so he did.
Wow.
And we milked it at the post, as you might imagine. We had video long before we were doing a lot of video. It was a big deal. And I remember one time when the cameras were off. So it was on the record, but it wasn't part of the interview. And he said, let me ask you a question. I said, what, Jim? He said, have you ever seen an owner who was treated this badly by his fans? He said, I'm serious. He said, I don't think there's ever been an owner who hears the crap I hear at the Garden all the time. And I let him talk for a while, and I smiled. And I'm like, well, you know, all due respect, but, you know, George Steinbrenner makes you seem like the most popular guy in town. And he's like, what are you talking about? When Steinbrenner died, they treated him like a king. I said, yeah, when he, you know, at the end, I said, but, you know, occasionally you get a guy who yells out, hey, Dolan, and you know, that makes you mad. You know, George would go to Yankee Stadium a couple of times, and they would chant his name, and they'd chant either one unprintable name before the name or one unprintable name after the name. And that's 40,000 people chanting it over and over again. I mean, it happened the day when Reggie came back and hit a home run to show up George. It happened later on when he got thrown out of baseball and Yankee Stadium starts to erupt in cheers and goodbye, George. And I said, you've never had that before. And so to his credit, Dolan thought about that and he smiled and he said, well, maybe they'll love me when I'm dead. And actually what Dolan has proven is that actually, oh, it doesn't mean that drastic because he's following the same blueprint George did. You win some games, all of a sudden you're not the most terrible owner in town anymore. You know, and winning, as you know, is Cowboys win a Super Bowl next year. You know, people aren't going to be crying, you know, complaining too much about the owner. I mean, that's what winning does. And, you know, winning changes a lot. You know, George became a lot more patient later on, you know, when his team was winning a lot because, you know, your trigger finger tends to be a little less itchy that way.
So when we talked about George Steinbrenner, and there's a detail in here that I had completely forgotten. And I'm 52 years old. I was an enormous baseball fan in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I still love the sport. I really like with the changes they've made to the game. It's made it a lot more. I really appreciate it.
Love it. Yeah.
But it was really fun to read some of these things because I had just forgotten them. And the one detail that you obviously have to go into that I had completely forgotten about, George Steinbrenner was suspended and basically evicted from Major League Baseball. I completely forgot about that. That Faye Vincent, who clearly didn't like him, had a reason to go in there and get rid of him. And this was not some case of Marge Schott. like what they had done with her when she had made her famous right. comment about Hitler was good in the beginning.
In the beginning, right.
In the beginning.
Right.
But this was a different kind of deal. Why do you think when we evaluate George Steinbrenner, for those of us left who do, why do you think this detail to his timeline suddenly just gets sort of sanded over and forgotten? Unlike, let's say, and I know it's not apples to apples, the Pete Rose situation. I can't figure out, when we think about George, we don't think about the fact he was kicked out of Major League Baseball.
Mac, you actually bring up a great point, and I think the Rose thing is a perfect allegory, and I actually use it really kind of to close the book. So you haven't gotten there yet. So you're so in tune with the book that you know how you know the ending. You don't have to get there anymore.
I know
because,
he dies
because I touched on it earlier with when Hal talks about his dad in the Hall of Fame. I actually asked George one time, "Do you think you belong in the Hall of Fame?" And he said, "I do not." He said the Hall of Fame should be people who played in uniforms, not for men who wore ties to the ballpark. I don't think he believed that, but that's what he told me. And for many years, I mean many years, and I got a lot of mileage writing columns, there's no way that George Steinbrenner belongs in the Hall of Fame. You know, my friend and colleague Joel Sherman says it this way. He says, you know, one suspension is par, two suspensions is over par. You can't get in the Hall of Fame if you're shooting over par. And you know, the ironic part of it is, you know, look, George was a dominant figure for the Yankees for 37 years, and yet the two prosperous times of their career both occurred when he was in absentia. The first time was when he was thrown out because he illegally contributed to the Nixon campaign, and that cost him 2 years. But during those 2 years, one of the guys he brought over in the original partnership group, Gabe Paul, very accomplished baseball man, built the first iteration of Championship Yankees under George. You know, he traded for Chris Chambliss and Dick Tidrow, and he traded for Bobby Bonds, and that yielded another trade, Mickey Rivers and Ed Figueroa and Willie Randolph. And he built that team when George was gone. And they won two championships when George came back, go figure. And later on, the second one we'll discuss, you know, Gene Michael, another guy from Ohio, you know, was installed. And he was the guy who made sure that the core four plus Bernie Williams weren't traded for Frank Viola on some trade deadline whim, like certainly George would have done had he been around. And, you know, and that's the thing to me, the same way that I did a 180 on Rose when I came to the conclusion that, A, I revere the Hall of Fame. I've probably been there 7 times in my life, and my wife won't go with me anymore because she knows that I'm not a guy who just breezes through the Hall of Fame. I read even the stuff I've read on past visits. I mean, it's an all-day thing for me. It's a pilgrimage for me. When I go now, I go with my friends, and only the friends who are baseball fans, because even my other friends who like baseball get tired after a while. So I have like 2 or 3 guys that I know will go with me and will be equally invested in their time in the walls of Cooperstown. But it's a museum, and it's a testament to the game's history. And look, history isn't always about great stuff. I mean, a responsible history book is going to mention, oh, by the way, there was slavery in the United States for a while, right? That's not a great thing. I mean, you don't whitewash the history. And so in baseball, you know, there really should be, you know, an accounting for things that did not go the way they should have gone. That's Pete Rose for sure. And I've often thought that the best way to solve that, if and when he ever gets in the Hall, I think he probably will at some point, but not right now, is that when they give him the plaque, you know, half of it is about why he merited to be in here, the 4,000 hits, the most games played, all that stuff, which is certainly Hall of Fame worthy. But the other half of the plaque has to detail why he wasn't in the Hall of Fame, what he did.
Totally agree.
Gambled on the game.
Yep.
Put that all on the plaque. And I think that's what you have to do for George Steinbrenner, too, is, look, I mean, this guy won 7 championships on his watch. Every other executive combined that's in the Hall of Fame have won 9. So, I mean, there's no question about, and I'm not saying you credit George for those 7 championships, but he was writing the check. So you got to get a little bit of credit. But also, look, I mean, the stuff that he did to get thrown out of baseball, that should be in there also, because they were both important. You know, they were both important enough to get suspended. And oh, by the way, you know, he didn't argue it at the time. I mean, now he was able to argue it later on because he thought he didn't realize what he was really accepting, a lifetime ban when he did. He was afraid the USOC that he had just become influential with was gonna take less kindly to the word suspension. Didn't realize that expulsion wasn't so great either. So he wound up out of that too for a while. But just think about the nuttiness of the spear thing. You're not the only guy for whom that's like a footnote that's kind of been forgotten, because I was talking to somebody else about that incident not long ago, and they said, yeah, the spear, and of course they hadn't read the book yet, but the spear, yeah, didn't George like hire a private eye or something to like get dirt on Winfield? That's his best player. That's crazy. I'm like, Yeah, that's crazy. But he didn't hire a private eye. He got involved with this low end gambler, hustler, you know, who was a disgruntled employee for the Winfield Foundation. And this guy was right out of a Runyon play. I mean, it's incredible that this is the guy that led him by the scruff of the neck out of baseball. He doomed him. Howie Spira, you know. And of course, what's hilarious is that the day he died wasn't hilarious, but, yeah. you know, columnist for the New York Post, I was on vacation in Belgium with my wife. Of course, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, that George Steinbrenner dies, yeah. You're going to write that day, right? Yeah. So my boss tracks me down, it's hilarious to go back and see the tributes. This everybody, you know, Donald Trump said one of yeah. one, you know, Reggie Jackson, just the greatest of all time. And the final quote was Howie Spira, I'm glad he's dead. So old Howie plans on taking that grudge into the next lifetime, too.
Because I've become a big person, someone who desperately believes these Hall of Fames and museums are there to chronicle the history of whatever topic yeah. it is. And right. you can't tell the stories without George Steinbrenner. You can't tell the stories without Pete Rose, good and the bad. And that's the part that sort of irritates me, which is just put them in, but tell the whole story. Tell the whole story. Yeah. And the part that irritates me is when I hear these former players who get their feelings hurt that they're not in the Hall of Fame say, oh, I don't care anymore. Dude, you would chew broken glass for a month to get in the right. Hall of Fame. So don't insult my intelligence. Like I hear Kurt Schilling say that. I'm like, you're full of crap.
Right.
Like you totally want it. And that's okay. Of course. But it's been one of my feelings of frustration with the Hall of Fame and some voters. I'm like, come on. Who are we? What are we doing here? Because there's one thing to your point. This is a big deal for these people, and it can have a significant financial yeah. impact on their lives if they do get in by being able to write HOF on their autograph. And I remember Michael Irvin explaining that to me, and it completely changed my attitude.
I believe that.
And I understand that. All right, I got a couple more questions for you. And one of them, you mentioned it briefly about Larry David and Seinfeld and its influence on the Yankees. And there's one part to this that I think people forgot is that George Steinbrenner famously hosted an episode of Saturday Night Live right after the Cincinnati Reds won the World Series.
Same day. They won.
Same day. That's
right. Todd Benzinger caught the final out.
And that's right.
15 minutes later, they were on SNL.
They're on air. And during that episode, George Steinbrenner wore a bra to make it look like he had breast implants during a sketch with the late Phil Hartman. Did all of this lampooning and making fun of the Yankees, more so Seinfeld than SNL, did it ever work against Steinbrenner and the Yankees, the fact that they put themselves in a position basically to be material for Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld?
I don't think so, because I think that by this time, everybody involved with the Yankees, starting with the owner, realized that this was a pretty famous brand. I mean, I would argue that the interlocking NY is, you know, name me a more famous logo in the world than that.
The only one I can think of is maybe the Dallas Cowboys star.
Yeah,
but I think the NY is bigger than any
of them. Yeah, because, you know, you just tend to see, you know, you see a lot of Yankees hats. You don't necessarily mm-hmm. see, so it's more ubiquitous that way, right?
Yep.
So it's funny, that they stole that logo from the New York Police Department. That was the original NYPD logo, so go figure. I think that to me that was one of the more the real fun parts about doing this book too was chronicling all the times he dabbled in pop culture.
Yeah.
Because you think about this guy being kind of a staid, you know, it's really funny. When he first took the team, he was 42 and he was hailed by the New York press as this young breath of fresh air. And one of the New York writers, certainly to his lasting regret, actually said, hey, Woodstock comes to New York. How about that? And I think that was probably the last time that George Steinbrenner was ever identified as a, you know, flower power child or something. but he also, this guy who always understood what New York, you know, the first time he heard New York, New York, was in a thundering PA system in Yankee Stadium, and he heard the words and he said, that's me. Small town blues melting away. And he's like, A number one, top of the hill, that's the Yankees. And yeah, that seems ultra serious and silly, but it's also, he understood the silliness and he understood that you could actually, you know, benefit and that the brand would benefit from that. You know, I mean, I think, you know, forget the Larry David as George stuff, which, you know, was funny, but, you know, there were other Yankees who appeared when Costanza was a traveling secretary, and he screwed up the reservations in Milwaukee. I mean, that makes the Yankees seem human, I think, right?
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, willing to lampoon themselves. So I think he appreciated that. You know, I remember when the miniseries came out, Jonathan Mailer had a great book a couple of years ago, Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning, and that became a miniseries on ESPN. John Turturro played Billy Martin. Oliver Platt played George. Oliver Platt's a pretty reputable actor, pretty distinguished actor. I mean, he's done a lot of things. And I remember I got a hold of him during that time to ask him about it. And he said, you know, it's funny. I was a Red Sox fan. I grew up in Canada, but I'm a Red Sox fan. So I was looking forward to just making fun of this guy for, you know, the 5 days of the shoot. But like, then I started to look into the character and, you know, I just really enjoyed it. It was a very challenging role. And, you know, you look back at the series, it's almost frightening how much he looks like him and how much he channels him. I mean, just his thing. And then, you know, and George, you know, George loved that stuff. You know, I mean, he was always appreciative of being able to extend boundaries beyond, you know, what was normal, what was expected, you know, and you know, he wasn't ever going to go nuts. But you know what? You asked before, here's another great thing that just occurred to me that I was amazed to see is, you know, one of the earliest defender, believe it or not, in public of Mike Kekich and Fritz Peterson when they, most 1973 thing ever, swapped wives and swapped families.
Oh, yeah.
Early in George's first year with the Yankees, you know, a bunch of fans were getting on Kekich's first outing with the Yankees that spring. He was getting slaughtered, and Steinbrenner gave it back to the fans. You know, I don't think Steinbrenner probably was approving of that lifestyle too much, but you know, he was his player. He was wearing the Yankee uniform. You know, he can surprise you, and I think that's certainly the part with the pop culture stuff that I think is really cool and was really a lot of fun to do. And you know, Larry David invited him to be on the episode himself, just as a cameo, and took even greater delight in the fact that Steinbrenner was so bad an actor that they couldn't use it. It is available on YouTube though, if you want to look it up.
Oh, I didn't know that. I've heard the Larry.
Yeah, him and Elaine Bettis have a little exchange. It's pretty.
I never knew that.
It's funny because he's a terrible actor, and of course the funny line when he runs on Saturday Night Live is, well, we tell him not to give up his day job, but he doesn't have a day job right now because he's just been suspended. So he really didn't have one to fall back on in the moment.
So, Mike, as someone who has been in New York for as long as you have, you can speak to great detail, painful detail, the drought. And I didn't know it was this bad. The championship drought that the greater New York area is mired in. And I'm going to see how well you know this. I'm going to put you on the spot. You ready? Okay. When was the last NFL Super Bowl the New York Jets won?
That was 1969, January 12th, 1969.
The last Super Bowl won by the New York Giants?
2011 season, so early 2012.
The New York Islanders?
1983. That was the one team I chose properly when I was a kid.
That was a good win.
I know the Islanders well. Yeah, that was a win.
The New York Rangers.
1994.
New York Yankees.
2009, which doesn't sound like that long ago, but for Yankee fans, might as well have been before Wi-Fi.
New York Mets.
1986.
New York Knicks.
1973.
Brooklyn Nets.
Well, you know, if you're going to count the ABA, and
no,
I do,
because
I
love
it. Not counting the ABA, then it's a zero.
Then do we count the Devils?
You know what? We only cover them briefly, but, you know, we want to make the point, you know,
right.
Hammer the point more, because they're actually, you know, they actually ruined a little bit. But, yeah, I think they were 2010, I think. I think maybe it was earlier than that. No,
so,
2002.
That's a hell of a list. You got them all right. Yeah, you got them all right. So does that make New York sports overrated?
I would say yes, except the fact that I don't think, at least around here, nobody expects much anymore. It's become, no, I mean, you should see what it's like now. You know, I lived in Fayetteville, a college town, right? I mean, you know, you've worked in DFW forever, so you've been around all these various college towns in Texas. We both covered games probably in Alabama and Oklahoma. These just unbelievable college towns. And my friend Chuck Culpepper once described New York as being Tuscaloosa with a skyline. And he's right to a degree.
one of many Chuck said? Tuscaloosa with a skyline?
I've stolen that a couple of times, but I always regretfully give him credit for it. But the fact of the matter is that New York is not a college town, and you should see what we're like for St. John's now. Oh, no, St. John's. Is,
okay. Do you see that shirt?
Yeah. Oh, God. I'm sorry. I did.
That's
all right.
That's my alma mater.
That's a tough beat for you.
But, that is a tough beat.
But I couldn't believe it. You know, I took the red eye home from that game. I was in San Diego covering the game. Just a fantastic game. Yeah, right. Just a great game. Not a well played game by any stretch. No, both those teams probably think they should have won the game by 15. Even the team that lost, because that first half was one to throw into the incinerator. But New York right now is head over heels for St. John's. And even guys, even people went to Fordham or Manhattan or Iona, maybe not Iona because they still have hard feelings about Patino. But it's amazing. It's become a college. It's become Tuscaloosa with a skyline again. I might actually write that today. And it's been a minute since we've had anything to write home about. And, you know, it's funny because there was a moment there where, you know, the Yankees were winning the series every year, including once when they beat the Mets. At the same time, the Knicks went to the finals. At the same time, the Rangers had just come off the Stanley Cup, and the Devils were winning a couple of Stanley Cups. And the Giants were in the Super Bowl. I mean, at the early part of my time with the Post, it was like, boy, this, you know, this is exhausting, but it's, you get a good team to write about every few months. And now it's just not
good. Give me something. You know? Mike, I don't mean to date you, but I had read you for a long time, and you were one of the people who covered the Yankees when I was very young, starting out, that there was this select group of people who covered the Yankees. I was covering the Texas Rangers. That was a very intimidating lot for me.
I bet.
And you would have been in that circle of people that I always looked at as like, they were here, and I still see that, you know, it's hard to change that impression from when you were, they were, you know, that sort of die is cast when you're young. And you were in that group to me, because the New York media throng can be very intimidating for out-of-towners, much in the same way Boston can, but New York, Philly, Boston, they all kind of had that. And I was, that could be really intimidating. And as I've gotten to know a few of you guys, Howard Bryant would be one.
Sure.
Verducci would be another one. And there's a ton of them. I've always been so pleasantly surprised, just how generally kind, nice, and really humble you all are. And I would certainly put you in that category. This went way too long, but I had more questions that I'm not going to bother you with. I really appreciate you doing this, especially, after catching a red eye back from San Diego. That's a long, long day.
No, I appreciate it, Mac. This has been a fun chat. I appreciate spreading the gospel about the bosses of the Bronx a little bit, but also talking about the other stuff we talked about.
Thanks.
Great
a
chat.
Lot.
These podcasts are just so much fun when you talk about things other than the one subject. And that's
right.
I'm glad you gave me the opportunity to do that, because it's been a lot of fun talking to you about it.
Thanks, Mike. Congratulations on the book. I wish you the very best of success and continued good health. And I look forward to continue reading your work. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Thanks, Mac. It was great talking to you.
Likewise. See you later.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I want to be a part of it.
This is a Stolen Water Media production.